Nearly 10 years ago, universities and colleges in western Wisconsin teamed up on a venture called the NanoRite Center. It was a business and research incubator dedicated to a burgeoning scientific field called nanotechnology. Around $5 million went into the project with the hopes that it would foster budding nanotech businesses in our region. Since then, the spotlight on nanotechnology has dimmed, or it has become more of a common occurrence in our scientific knowledge as the layperson. But still, in the Chippewa Valley, it exists. In this hour, we'll talk with experts and educators about how this field has evolved in our region and what implications it has for all of us and how we all use nanotechnology. This is The West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and I'm joined by three educators from the Chippewa Valley. First, I'd like to introduce UW-Eau Claire Associate Professor of Materials Science, Jennifer Dahl. Thank you so much for joining us, Jennifer.
Thank you for inviting me.
Our pleasure to have you. And next, Chippewa Valley Technical College Engineering Technology Instructor, Hans Michelson. Hans, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
And UW-Stout Engineering I just used the same title. We've got Matthew Ray. He is a chemistry professor at UW-Stout, correct?
Yep, that's correct.
All right. And listeners, we want to hear from you as well. The number to call in is 1-800-228-5615. That number again is 1-800-228-5615. We're talking about nanotechnology, the courses offered in western Wisconsin, and the NanoRite, now the Applied Technology Lab Center here in Eau Claire. And if you'd like to comment, but you don't feel like going on air, give us a question or comment on our West Side Facebook page. So, Matthew, I'll start with you. What is nanotechnology? It sounds like a big umbrella term.
Yeah, nanotechnology really could be best described as materials that have at least one dimension that is in between 1 and 100 nanometers in scale. So some of them, like nanoparticles, might have all three. And so you might have a particle that's only about 5 nanometers or 10 nanometers in size. You might have some nanorods that could have an aspect ratio of maybe 10 nanometers in diameter, but yet be up to several microns in size, or much, much longer. It's kind of like a rod or a javelin in shape.
Okay.
You can have other dimensions, such as nanosheets, such as graphene, where you have one dimension that's very, very thin, and maybe the others are quite large, like sheets of paper. And so all those would be classified as nanotechnology.
And sheets, rods, spears, I mean, this is all very technical to me. So let's focus on one, this graphene. It's something that really fascinates me. Hans Michelson, basically, this is something that's very thin, but also incredibly strong, made out of carbon, right?
Yes, it's carbon forms a six-membered ring structure. And if you look at graphite on a pencil, your pencil is made out of graphite, but that can be broken down into a single sheet of that's only one molecule or one atom thick, so a single atomic layer thick. And they've been experimenting this and found that it has some really interesting properties. So there's some advanced electronic properties. They're able to make things like transistors using graphene, and so it's expected to sort of revolutionize electronics. And so there are a lot of applications for that. I saw a recent article that showed they had developed a graphene light bulb that was more efficient than LED light bulbs.
Yeah, it's crazy, and it can also be used as a water filtration device. I mean, it's super strong. Jennifer Dahl, we're talking about carbon that's just been manipulated a little bit at the atomic level?
Yes, that's one way to think of it. And I think the term manipulate, if we were to address some of the biggest challenges in nanotechnology, it would be our ability to manipulate these materials. So as we've pointed out already, what makes something nano? It means something has an incredibly small dimension of size. At least one dimension is really small. And so that means that a lot of what we would want to do in order to process these materials into, say, a new electronic device means that we can't exactly dictate where individual components of this structure would go. As we kind of think of the difference between building a material with Legos, right? So suppose you had your hands available mm-hmm. and you were able to pick up each Lego and put it into place, right, to make a hopefully, I don't know, maybe a really cool Mars rover out of it. I don't know. So that's not too challenging as long as you have a design in mind. But when we're working with nanomaterials and we think about building complex structures using nanoscale components, it's kind of like trying to manipulate Legos with giant, thick mittens on, if you want to think of it that way. It's really difficult to pick up individual pieces and dictate where they should go. And so there's a lot more of a challenge in trying to drive these materials to assemble themselves into a useful device. So we have to be a little bit more sophisticated in our handling of these materials, our ability to modify their surfaces chemically in order to drive these assembly processes. And I think that is part of what has eluded some of our development of the real promises of nanotechnology.
Well, we're talking about these materials and the pieces, the Legos that we're talking about. We're talking about the individual atom, moving atoms around, or no, am I off?
Not quite. We're talking about moving individual clusters of atoms. So if we go with the example of a nanoparticle, a little three-dimensional nanomaterial, we could be talking about clusters composed of as few as 100 atoms. Mm. Right? It's not just the size dimension that makes nanomaterials relevant. It's the fact that their chemical and physical properties are drastically different than the bulk material. They can do something. They have some property that we cannot access with larger materials.
I want to talk about that a little bit later, but first, is there any kind of way that we can help the people at home visualize what scale we're talking about here? You hear nanometers, that sounds very small, but if you actually compared it to something like, a piece of paper or anything, Matthew?
Yeah, I think I've got a good way to do this. So I want you to just kind of picture in your mind a basketball. Just imagine you're holding a basketball. So because of the space race and such, we have a pretty good picture of how big the Earth is. And so now imagine the Earth. The Earth is 51 million times bigger than that basketball. So in other words, if you could drill a hole right through the center of the Earth and stack it full of basketballs, there'd be 51 million basketballs from one end of the Earth to the other. So now imagine holding that basketball again. The scale smaller than that, the nanoscale, is 51 million times smaller than that. And so a 5-nanometer nanoparticle, is the exact same jump from the nanoparticle to the basketball, from the basketball to the Earth.
Wow.
And so the scale of 51 million is kind of a magic number. And so in that little nano world, that basketball man, a 6-foot man, would stand 36 nanometers tall and could play basketball with a 5-nanometer gold nanoparticle. And so that's really the scale. If you can imagine being that little tiny nano man walking on that basketball, we're talking about a pretty small scale.
That's crazy. I love that. The number to call in is 800-228-5615. We're talking about nanotechnology in Western Wisconsin with three educators from Western Wisconsin. I'm joined by Associate Chemistry Professor at UW-Stout, Matthew Ray. Jennifer Dahl is a UW-Eau Claire Associate Professor of Materials Science and Chippewa Valley Technical College Engineering Technology Instructor is with us here as well. I'm tongue-tied beyond belief today. Hans Michelson. I was up at 5 in the morning, so bear with me. 800-228-5615 is the number to call in with your questions or comments. We've got wide-open phone lines. So Hans Michelson, was nanotechnology something that was created or discovered? How do we approach that?
Well, there's two terms. One is nanoscience and one is nanotechnology. So nanoscience would be the study of science at the really small scale. Nanotechnology sort of implies that you're able to do things at that scale and manipulate at that scale. So in that sense, nanotechnology would have to be invented, really. being able to manipulate and do things at that size scale. So it's been talked about for a long time. Richard Feynman was a physicist who gave a famous talk. There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom, where he described a lot of the concepts that we now associate with nanotechnology. Being able to manipulate and work at all the way down to the very atomic scale, or work with individual molecules to have them do specific things.
And that was with the 50s, or was it earlier than the 50s?
59.
Yeah, that's the theory was there. We couldn't really operate at that level at the time because we didn't have – we couldn't see stuff that small, right, Jennifer?
That's exactly the key, is that we couldn't see what we were dealing with. We didn't know what we were dealing with. So playing off the idea of nanoscience versus nanotechnology, nanomaterials have been around for centuries, right? So some of which we can think of naturally occurring nanomaterials, such as small particles that we associate with volcanic activity, right? So small particles in the atmosphere. Early examples of stained glass and some glazes for pottery contained metal nanoparticles. And we just didn't know that it was these little clusters of metals that were responsible for the color. We also didn't know why the color of materials could change so drastically. A lot of things that we, playing off that example of glass, we didn't know that it was necessarily gold nanoparticles that were giving rise to red colors in glass. Silver can look yellow, right? So there are certain elements that we could associate with these unusual colors that are very, very different than what we think of gold and silver as looking like, right? But better yet, once we were able to see these particles, we discovered more about them. We discovered that properties such as color were dependent upon the exact size of the nanoparticles. You can create silver nanoparticles that appear to be just about every color of the visible spectrum based on their size. Hmm. Right? So you've not changed the base material whatsoever. You've just made those particles a little bigger or a little smaller. We also know that the shape of those materials will also give rise to new properties. And none of this was possible until we had the tools to really see what we were dealing with and examine it. So the advent of electron microscopy was huge for understanding the structure of nanomaterials, and then further characterization methods that allowed us to get at some of the chemical and physical behavior of nanomaterials really is what enabled a good understanding of nanoscience. So with that information in place, that's when nanotechnology is born. That's when you can start thinking, well, what can I do with this? How can I make a better transistor? How can I make better medicines? How can I make better pigments for materials? There's a wide range of what you can do with nano, and it all comes down to being able to see it and understand it.
So if we're talking about molecules, we're talking about sometimes at the atomic level, I'm starting to understand now why it might be akin to wearing heavy gloves and trying to work with something as small as a Lego. 800-228-5615 is the number to call in. We've got wide open phone lines. So why do materials behave so differently when they're manipulated, or when you get to that scale and you move stuff around? Matthew Ray.
Well, I think you probably compare it to a low-resolution image. So we've probably seen examples of having a picture that was saved at a small scale, and then you blow it up and print it. It's pixelated. Mm-hmm. You can see the boxy nature of that image. And so at the nanoscale, you actually get pixelated material, because the atoms themselves can be seen. And so in that example of the basketball to the nanoparticle, that nanoparticle that's 5 nanometers, you would see bumps on the surface as if it were held together by gluing marbles together. Hmm. You can actually see that you're one step away from the atomic scale. And so that gives rise to a lot of very unique properties. And so one could say that an atom of a material behaves differently than an ingot, a cast billet or ingot of material. And so gold as an atom is quite different than gold as a gold bar. Hmm. Well, it turns out there's this I guess you'd say, adolescence period, from that very infantile atom to the big bar, where you get a whole host of new properties because it's behaving as a small grouping. And so you get very interesting optical properties. As Jennifer was talking about, the color is quite different. It's not gold in color. It's red or it's yellow. And so you can get very interesting fluorescence behavior. And so it will absorb light in the ultraviolet and emit in a visible way, in a visible spectrum. Mm. Things like electrical properties, mechanical properties, even catalytic properties. And so it can instigate chemical reactions that it would not otherwise have because of the presence of these unique surface atoms and that very, very high surface area that's really present in all nanomaterials. So if you imagine taking a larger object, you know, think about a racquetball in size. If that was made out of plastic, that would weigh about 100 grams or about a quarter pound if it was solid plastic. So if that could be reduced in size from, say, 2 or 3 inches down to 100 nanometers, pulverize that into billions of little particles that are 100 nanometers in size, the surface area of that racquetball goes from being, you know, less than a square foot to being a football field in size of total surface area, total real estate of that new surface area from the pulverized particles. That gives rise to a whole host of new behavior, new reactivity, just because of all of the surface area that you have opened up for chemical reaction or interaction with those particles.
And when you get down to that level, if you can create a coating that gets in between there, I mean, isn't that how scientists are able to make things super resistant to water or what have you?
Well, it's by manipulating the interactions at that level. And so if the water wants to stay as a droplet, you can prevent it from soaking into a material by making it water resistant or hydrophobic. Mm-hmm. And so certainly this is the way that you can control and manipulate things at that level.
We've got a caller on the line, and we're going to go to Chippewa Falls, I believe. We've got Bob. Bob, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, thank you. I teach people to deal with asbestos.
Okay.
And, of course, the asbestos is kind of a nanofiber. And I'm a little bit concerned that we could be creating a problem with people breathing these materials in as they wear or as they're created or as they're manufactured. Would you just comment on that?
Sure. Jennifer Dahl.
You have hit upon a really, really important issue here. So within the asbestos example, we do know that much of the mechanism by which asbestos becomes dangerous is the fact that the fibers of asbestos delaminate, that is, sheets of smaller and smaller pieces of asbestos are shed as once the material is in the body, and this then leads to some of the damage that we associate with lung disorders like mesothelioma and such. Mm-hmm. So we know that nanomaterials can be incredibly damaging. And also, because the nanomaterials are so tiny, it means that they are very low mass. They don't play with gravity very well. And so our caller is right that we do need to be concerned about airborne nanomaterials. Fortunately for us, with the inception of nanotechnology has come some lessons of the past in terms of environmental health and safety. And so as we develop these processes and we think about implementing them in a manufacturing setting, we're taking advantage of that information and we're exploring how to best handle these materials before it ever gets into the consumer space. It would be completely reckless to develop this technology in the absence of that type of information. So we know that, you know, as an example, if somebody in my lab were to spill a vial of nanoparticles that are dry, so that is, they're not in a solution, the worst thing they could possibly do to contain that mess would be to try to vacuum it, right? Because those particles would pass right through the filters of the vacuum and they'd become airborne.
Hmm.
So rather it's best to contain that material within a liquid. So that these are all things that we need to know. And there nationwide, there is the a nanotechnology initiative to explore some of the safety and health implications of nanomaterials. Researchers can submit new materials to this initiative for studies of exactly how this material could affect biological systems. So starting out with looking at aquatic systems, thinking about how fish, like zebrafish, could be impacted by this. They happen to be a great choice because they're exquisitely sensitive to changes in their environment. All the way up to studies with how with mammals. So we know something about how these materials could permeate through skin. What are they going to do in the lungs? What can they possibly do to a digestive tract? What if we're deliberately introducing nanomaterials as medicine? What is the ultimate fate of those materials? Are they excreted and metabolized, or do they remain in the body? And if so, what happens? So these manufacturing life cycle considerations are something that we have in mind as we develop nanotechnology.
Bob, thanks so much for the call. I appreciate it. Number for anyone else to call in or to ask a question or offer a comment, 800-228-5615. We're talking about nanotechnology and some of the course offerings in Western Wisconsin. We're going to get to that in just a bit as far as nanotech is concerned. And we'll talk about the NanoRite, the formerly known as NanoRite Center. 800-228-5615. I'm joined by Associate Professor of Chemistry at UW-Stout, Matthew Ray. Hans Michelson of Chippewa Valley Technical College. He's an engineering technology instructor there. And UW-Eau Claire Associate Professor of Materials Science, Jennifer Dahl. We'll be back with more West Side in just a bit.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Dells, presenting the 2015 Automotion Classic Car Show. 1,200 cars, one weekend, May 16th and 17th. More at wisdells.com. Wisconsin Dells, the water park capital of the world. Support also comes from Saint A, a foster care and special needs adoption service, dedicated to finding loving, caring homes for vulnerable children since 1850. More information is available at growhope.net.
I'm Rich Kramer. You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. We're talking about nanotechnology in Western Wisconsin. I'm joined by UW-Eau Claire Associate Professor of Materials Science, Jennifer Dahl, Chippewa Valley Technical College Engineering and Technology Instructor, Hans Michelson, and UW-Stout Professor of Chemistry, Matthew Ray. The number to call in is 800-228-5615. Before we get into some of the applications of nanotech and some of the things we might have that involve nanotech, you know, in our homes or in our pockets for that matter, I want to get back to the health and the safety issue, because one of the things that I follow a lot is this industrial frac sand mining, and the dust that people are concerned about, that's not even at the nanoscale. We're talking microns, 2.5 or so, and that stuff is so small that it can pass through the lungs into the bloodstream, I guess. So I would imagine that this nanoparticle dust could do the very same thing. And earlier, Matthew Ray, you mentioned the gold basketball, the gold at at that level. Now, I was reading and I found out that gold is when it's injected into the body, the small nanoparticles of gold can kind of latch onto tumors and can either illuminate it for the clinical staff that are looking for it?
Yeah, absolutely. So nanoparticles can be tagged with, for instance, antibodies that are specific to different surfaces. Like, you could have an antibody that's attached to a gold nanoparticle that was intentionally grown so that it would have complementary attraction to a tumor cell. And then that gold nanoparticle could be introduced into the body, and it would find the tumor and stick to it, essentially. So if you put other drugs or other biologically active entities on it, like a drug that would eventually break off and then move into whatever is around it, you could target, say, drug delivery with a small particle. Another way that's done is you can attach particles onto a tumor and then illuminate it with a laser, a visible light laser or an infrared laser, to cause localized heating in the vicinity of that particle. And you can cause thermal death of the tumor and yet keep the rest of the body intact. And so it certainly has been investigated as a way to get these little nano soldiers that can find exactly what the problem is and allow you to target therapeutics, and so that's one big area.
But what happens after? Is that, does that gold stay in the person, or is it, have we found out yet?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I don't know that the full toxicity is fully understood. I would say that for gold and silver particles, there have been tests that have shown that those are not toxic. And therefore, the ultimate life cycle, presumably it would be excreted eventually, or it could be taken up into cells and be passive and just not really interact in any bad way. And so for some, the toxicity is more well-known than other nanomaterials.
Sure.
Jennifer, don't. And actually, playing up on that, I'll add that keep in mind that if we're using these materials as nanomedicines, the dose of what we need is incredibly tiny. So if we're talking about injecting somebody with gold nanoparticles, we're talking about a couple of milligrams for a single dose of these materials, right? They are known to, in the case of gold and silver, they are known to stay in the body, but they are inert, right? They don't do anything until we activate them with rather intense light to cause the so-called hyperthermic, you know, burning of damaged tissue. So otherwise, they're quite benign, and they present a real advantage to the patient. In the case of cancer treatments, you know, think about all of the things that are so difficult for the patient to endure. You know, most medicines that we use for our cancer work by being exquisitely toxic, right? So we kill the tumor, but then we potentially, you know, kill healthy tissue as well. So the ability to be very specific with where these materials go, and the fact that they cause very little damage afterwards, and we use such small amounts of the materials, creates some real advantages.
It sounds promising. Hans Michelson, that's one application for nanotechnology, which again is a huge term, umbrella term. What are some of the real world, you know, you have in your house or in your pocket applications where nanotechnology is involved?
Yeah, I just wonder if I could follow up
sure,
on that a
do.
Bit. So there's two other applications in medicine that are out there. One of them is that a lot of drugs that are developed by the pharmaceutical companies are not very soluble. You need to get them into your bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we see with by making particles extremely small is that their solubility starts to increase, and so they're able to use different drugs, that different formulations of pharmaceuticals that normally they couldn't use, and be able to accept those into the body.
Mm.
There's actually a company in the Twin Cities called Nanocopia that just had a huge investment in their company because they were able to produce machines that produce these very small pharmaceutical particles reliably, and they're partnering with some pharmaceutical companies. And
cool.
So that's one of the regional successes we've had in nanotechnology. Another one is training the immune system to attack tumors. And so by treating nanoparticles with markers that are similar to the markers that show up on cancer cells, they've been able to train like white blood cells to attack tumor cells. So you, basically after this training, your own immune system is able to go after the tumor and attack the tumor, so you don't have to, you don't have to introduce a foreign agent into the body in order to use nanotechnology to attack tumors.
Basically tricking the body to heal itself.
Or training it to heal
training.
Itself.
That's wild.
But to get back to your question on other things, I mean, your cell phone is a good example there.
But what in the cell phone?
Well, there's transistors in there that are made out of that are so small, there's in order to detect the signal, to pick up the radio frequencies, they have to be so fast at switching that they have to make them extremely small. So there's a couple of transistors in there. The battery technology is another example.
Mm.
If you look look at a company like Tesla Motors. They just introduced a battery. Now, they didn't talk about the technology.
No.
But in order to get really efficient batteries, nanotechnology is one of the main ways that they're trying to do use to do that. You're going to achieve extremely high energy storage efficiencies because, again, it gets back to the surface area.
Sure.
The higher the surface area of the particle, the more energy you can store in a smaller space. And so these batteries can get extremely high efficiency. And if you look at, you know, we're in the spring here and you get a lot of storms come through, could knock some trees down. If you had a little box outside your house that could store a day or two worth of energy, electrical energy, you get a power outage, you really wouldn't have to do too much. You stop watching TV for a couple days, turn off your electronics, your refrigerator is fine.
Okay.
2 or 3 days later, the power comes back on. It's like nothing happened. You still had electricity the whole time. So I can see these things becoming ubiquitous at some point where everybody will have local storage of energy. That also enables alternative energy systems like solar power, wind generation. Being able to store it is really one of the key factors mm-hmm. to alternative energy systems.
With the Tesla battery, a lot of people are already talking about it as some kind of a game changer and you know, getting a step closer to totally separating yourself from the grid, et cetera. But it's excellent. Surface area, who would have thought? I know it makes sense when I read it and when you all explain it to me, but when things get that small, the fact that there'd be more surface areas is just hard to get my head around. So in the Chippewa Valley, there was a lot of excitement over nanotechnology, and Hans, I'll stay with you. Why was this such a hot topic? I mean, it seemed like it was just all in the news. Was it like was it just the latest buzz kind of thing, or?
I think there was sort of a buzz about it, and CVTC President Bill Eilenfeld wanted to really go after that momentum there, and he founded the or helped to promote and build the the NanoRite Center out at the CVTC West Campus. And when that was conceived, he had a consultant come in, and they said, well, this should be a mixed nano and micro center. And so that was about in 2005 that they built that and finished it. For a while, it didn't take off right away, and it was about only 30% full. As companies started moving into that, some of them were nanotech, and of course we also had microtech. We had an electronics company. We ended up with some vitamin. They ended up with some vitamin companies there, and some food companies. And so, but they all had a focus at the micro scale or the nano scale. Eventually, now it's 100% full, so the center is pretty successful. But because it had a more diverse companies, they changed the name to the Applied Technology Center. So it's still an incubator. Companies come in, lease space. They have access to laboratory space. They have access to larger warehouse areas where they can do manufacturing. It's taken a while. I think the recession from 2008 sort of hit it a little bit hard at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's the center is actually full now at 100% capacity. So.
And you and I were speaking the other day about one of the companies that makes food additives at the Applied Technology Center,
mm-hmm.
and you mentioned that they still are, you know, they're at that level where they're really manipulating. And what was it? It was
sure. So there's a company called Fiberstar, and they make a food ingredient. And this is a natural. It's made from citrus pulp. So the pulp that you don't like to eat if some people don't like it in their orange juice.
Sure.
And they process it to increase the surface area, and that gives it special properties, the same as other things. And they study that at the microscopic or the nanoscopic scale to see what changes they've done to it, and that helps them to characterize their product. So they use electron microscopes to analyze that and study it. To tell what how they've changed the material, and that's used to add it to foods, and you increase the amount of fiber you get in your food. You can reduce the amount of oil and fat that you add to your food. Mm. So it's considered a healthy food ingredient that they make there, and it's very the material would otherwise just be a waste material.
Sure.
So from the orange juice plants.
Now I want to speak to all of you individually about what the university or your university or college has been doing to kind of keep the momentum going, I suppose, in nanotechnology. Let's start with Matthew Ray at UW-Stout. What kind of offerings do students have there, and what kind of jobs can they look forward to if they get some training at Stout?
Yeah, sure. So currently the nanoscience-based emphases are housed within the Bachelor of Science in Applied Science degree there at Stout. That is really threefold currently. You have the materials and nanoscience emphasis. You have biotechnology and biochemistry, molecular biology, kind of a more traditional biology degree. Mm-hmm. And there's also interdisciplinary science. Those three topics are held within the Bachelor's of Science degree in Applied Science. It's kind of a customizability for the student to choose the path they want. So within materials and nanoscience, there are three emphasis areas. And so the students can focus on materials physics. They can focus on nanobiotechnology. And kind of one of the ones that we're pretty proud of, pretty interested in, is the emphasis in entrepreneurship. It's kind of a brainchild of Forrest Schultz from our department that he wanted to see the ability to train a student in science and also give them some core competency in business so that they can go out and start businesses or contribute to growing businesses and leverage that knowledge of science in the business realm. And so that's been online for about 2 years. We've got students in that track of the program. As far as the courses specifically, really nanotechnology is just an outcropping of material science. And so many of the traditional things you need to learn for a degree in material science also apply to nanotechnology. And so beyond learning about metals and ceramics and polymers and composites and the strength of those materials, we also have four specific courses about nanotechnology. The first one, Nano 101, is Explorations in Nanotechnology. This is kind of a survey course. It's a general education course as well. It's open to all students. And they can learn just what the scene is on nanotechnology. Then we've got a characterization methods course, and that's a course where the students interact with electron microscopes, atomic force microscopes, scanning probe microscopes to get the skills necessary to characterize nanomaterials. And so every student gets hands-on time with those techniques. We've also got a small clean room, and they learn clean room technique so that they are competent in that area. Then it moves on to nanostructures, a course that's really about the synthesis, the unique characteristics of these nanomaterials, and they learn a lot about how to make these things. And then finally, there's a course about applications where it's kind of a research capstone where they can apply what they've learned in a research project to try to discover new things, to try to apply recently discovered things and see if they can do it for themselves. Beyond that, we have a variety of research projects in the departments that contribute to this that the students can engage in. We've got research projects involving carbon nanotubes and gold nanoparticles, as well as iron nanoparticles. And we've also got a professor that models, does modeling of behavior, mathematical modeling of this. I do a lot with polymer particles through emulsion polymerization, very small polymer particles. And so there's a variety of different ways that you can get students involved and engage these materials.
Jennifer Dahl at UW-Eau Claire, similar situation. Is some specific courses within a broader degree path?
Yeah, except I think we have a somewhat different model. So as you mentioned in your introductions, I'm in the material science program. And so our degree, our primary degree that we offer is a bachelor's of science in material science,
okay,
with different emphases. So kind of taking this menu-driven approach to allow the students to gain skills that kind of match their area of interest. So some students opt for an emphasis in nanoscience. Others go for an emphasis in chemistry, physics, entrepreneurship, electronics. There's many ways that the student can fine-tune the degree to their specific area of interest. But while we have courses that are broken out and characterized as exclusively nanoscience, with materials, keep in mind that any kind of material can be nano. So any metal, ceramic, polymer, semiconductors, right? All of those classic areas of materials, they show up on the nanoscale. So aside from having those courses that are dedicated exclusively to the topic of nano, we have a training in nanoscience cutting through our entire curriculum. There isn't a class that you're going to take in our department that doesn't emphasize the unique nature of nanomaterials. But we really feel that you need to have it helps if you have a good background in how in the behavior of metals and
sure,
other materials on the larger scale. And then you can compare that to how drastically these things change when you're dealing with nanomaterials. So it's a slightly different model. I think it has a pretty similar result. We also dedicate a lot of our resources to undergraduate research. I think that is, in my view, it's the most powerful education tool that we have. My most successful students started research as freshmen, and they have worked with me all the way through their degree program. Hmm. And so we've never felt that a student has to wait to engage in this topic. Our freshmen start out with materials characterization early on, so learning all these key skills that employers are looking for in the lab. So being able to use various types of electron microscopes and atomic force microscopes, different chemical characterizations, different ways of characterizing materials mechanically, right? That's there throughout our entire program.
And at CVTC, Hans Michelson, what kind of offerings, specialties do you do there?
Yeah, so we have what started out as our nanoscience program, we now have an engineering technology program. And again, like the other schools, we have different emphasis areas. So nano engineering is one of our emphasis areas. You can also we also have manufacturing engineering, which is very popular, and industrial engineering, which is targeted toward the food manufacturing industry. Within each of those, within the nano engineering area, again, we're trying to train technicians to work in an advanced manufacturing lab, a clean room, possibly in biotechnology. And so we have some core skills in stuff like workplace safety, engineering principles, and CAD. But then we have specialty courses in biotechnology, engineering materials, fundamentals of nanoscience, and quality assurance. So those would all be in the nano engineering degree.
We're talking about nanotechnology and course offerings in Western Wisconsin. We're going to take our final break. We'll be back, and we'll talk a little bit about how the U.S. fares in terms of global competition in the field of nanotechnology. And also we'll talk about budgets, about funding, believe it or not. 800-228-5615 is the number to call. I am joined by Associate Chemistry Professor at UW-Stout, Matthew Ray, Chippewa Valley Technical College Engineering Technology Instructor, Hans Michelson, and UW-Eau Claire Associate Professor of Materials Science, Jennifer Dahl. 800-228-5615. We'll be back in just a bit.
I'm Marcia Stewart from Madison, Wisconsin. If people do have a matching gift program at their employer, they're missing out on a tremendous opportunity because for every dollar that I give, there's money out there that also is available. It's like leaving free money on the table. Why not take advantage of that? I'm a sustaining member, and my employer, Merrill Lynch Bank of America, matches my donations to WPR.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Celebrate International Museum Day at the Chippewa Valley Museum Sunday, May 17th. Test your powers of observation during an exhibit scavenger hunt and a lot more while getting a buy one adult admission, then receive another admission at half off. Details at cvmuseum.com.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking about nanotechnology in Western Wisconsin. I'm joined by Jennifer Dahl of UW-Eau Claire, Hans Michelson of Chippewa Valley Technical College, and Matthew Ray of UW-Stout, 800-228-5615, to squeeze a comment or a question in. We have wide open phone lines. I was looking at a report, just scanning it, from last year. This was from the Government Accountability Office at the federal level, and it said that that some of the investment was kind of waning, and also that investment in nanotechnology and nanoscience there was a missing middle, it said. That is a gap between research and development and actually getting to the production point and actually producing technologies at scale. So as far as investment goes, has it changed? Federal state funding, has it waned a little bit? And if so, is it going to where it needs to go? I'll start with Jennifer Dahl.
The funding landscape has changed dramatically in the past 10 years. There's less of it, and there's more people applying for it. So it has become a lot more competitive. But that has, I think, driven us to reach out to alternative funding sources. I myself have had a lot of success in working with the WISIS Technology Foundation. They have funded and sponsored my research for the past several years. Mm-hmm. And also UW System has supported my work in the form of a grant, a Regent Scholar for the year. So mm-hmm. they've invested in my work because it is viewed as something that is likely to yield some economic development here within the state. It's absolutely changed. I think there's people want results with research, and there's a tendency to favor things that appear to be so-called applied projects, things that are near market. Yet I think we're ultimately suffocating our progress in that area if we don't also support fundamental research, too. There are so many discoveries that don't appear to be immediately useful or applicable,
sure,
but they become so in you know, a matter of a decade or so. So it's we're investing in those further commercially viable developments if we also support fundamental research.
And Hans Michelson, as far as the rankings, you know, globally, where does the U.S. fare? I mean, are we losing an edge to other countries as far as research, development, investment in this technology?
Well, I think traditionally investment at the federal level has been fairly high compared to a lot of other countries.
Mm-hmm.
However, one of the things that does concern me that I see are a lot of the micro and nano fabrication jobs that move to companies overseas, other countries. And when I look at that, it's sort of like it's not really a switch that you can turn off and turn on developing this really advanced technology. If you're not making the cutting-edge, most advanced microprocessor chip in this country and you want to try to make that again, you can't just turn that on. There are quality issues that have to be addressed, and those quality issues are it's so hard to bring the quality up to a level to manufacture those parts, that if we lose that advanced technology, that advanced manufacturing capability, we may not be able to turn that back on again. And a lot of that is moving overseas now. So I'm sort of concerned about that.
And Matthew Ray, would you like to see more money from either the federal government or even the state. I mean, we've got a budget that potentially could cut a large chunk from the UW system, also from the tech college system. There's a tuition freeze in there as well.
Yeah, obviously the money still needs to be there. I think that what we're seeing is sort of a realignment from some pretty lofty claims of 10 years ago to probably a more realistic view of what's going to happen. I mean, back 10 years ago, people are saying, well, we could have space elevators and things that are writing carbon nanotubes up to the stars.
Right.
And so, you know, I think that there's some unrealism there. I think that the bottom line is that material science is here to stay. We need strong materials to make things, our cars, our planes, our electronics out of. And so nanotechnology is enabling a very big growth area in that topic. And so the funds still need to be there, but I think that we need to be more realistic with our expectations. You know, I think that there's three different types of companies out there that are aligned with nanotech. You've got some companies where it's their main research focus. They're all about nanotech. That's what they supply. Some of them are infusing products with it, making composite materials, making things stronger, lighter, faster, better. Mm-hmm. And so they'll say, yes, we're using nanotechnologies. Then you've got a whole sector that they're using nanotech, but they don't either know it or they don't call it that. I mean, paints and coatings and inks and a lot of things in biology are nanotechnology, but they just don't necessarily emphasize that aspect. But honestly, all three of these areas, whether it's overt or covert, are benefiting from the things that are taught in the universities concerning nanotechnology because it's building foundation. It's building intuition that's enabling their products to be smarter and better and faster. And it's going to have an effect, a positive effect.
So either we've already seen it or we need to see some sort of an attitude change about all of this?
Well, I think that the progress is more slow than what people expect. You know, they want to say, new topic, let's have billion-dollar companies started in Wisconsin tomorrow.
Right.
I think it's more of a grassroots. It has to settle into the areas that it can grow, and we're going to see it infuse in the products. It's just going to take some time.
All right. Well, with that, we're at the top of the hour. I want to thank all my guests very much for their conversation and their insight on this issue of nanotechnology in Western Wisconsin. Many thanks to Associate Chemistry Professor at UW-Stout, Matthew Ray. Many thanks to Chippewa Valley Technical College Engineering Technology Instructor Hans Michelson. And many thanks to UW-Eau Claire Associate Professor of Materials Science at Jennifer Dull. Thank you all very much. Thanks for the caller who had a great question. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Rich Kramer. Next week, we're going to talk about foraging for food in Western Wisconsin. We're going to be joined by Brett Laidlaw and I'm forgetting his name, but look for it on our Westside Facebook page. I'm Rich Kramer. Have a safe and productive week. We'll chat again next Monday morning.